I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. As cranes reshape Kansas City's midtown and downtown landscape, neighborhoods in the 5th District continue to struggle with violent crime and basic services like trash collection. Today, we'll speak with the two fresh faces fighting for Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy's seat. We'll ask them about illegal dumping, pocket parks, and expanding Kansas City's momentum south and east. Then, women are asking for raises at the same rate as their male counterparts. They just aren't getting them. So we'll get advice for women looking to negotiate their pay successfully, and we'll ask how a new Kansas City ordinance could help close the gender pay gap. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Two weeks from today, Kansas Citians will head to the polls to pick a new mayor and a new city council. As part of our ongoing series on the candidates for city council, today we'll be talking to the two candidates for the 5th District in-district race. Kansas City's 5th District wraps itself around Raytown and comprises some of the most challenged neighborhoods in the entire city down in the southeast quarter. The two candidates vying to succeed current Councilwoman Alicia Kennedy are Raina Park Shaw. She's a lifelong resident of Kansas City. She led the region's only adult sickle cell center at Truman Medical Center, where she was an associate administrator. Raina, nice to have you. Welcome.
Thank you very much.
Edward Bell II is also a native son of Kansas City. He's an educator and executive consultant. Ed, nice to have you. Welcome.
Good morning.
Why in the world would you want a job like this? As I've mentioned to other candidates in these conversations, this is a pretty tough job. Ed, why do you want it?
Public service is where my heart is. It's where my focus is. It's how I was raised. And I just feel an intrinsic need to give back to the community that's made an investment in me. And any progress is going to require a little bit of struggle, a little bit of adversity. But we really need public service that's going to change the culture of how we see politics, but also how we see ourselves in our neighborhoods and our communities.
Raina, how about you?
You know, for me, it's near and dear to me being a healthcare executive for 25 years and learning that your zip code can dictate your life expectancy was appalling to me. And so it's important to me to utilize my skill set to be able to impact the fact that people in the 5th District live up to 15 years less than a neighboring district. And so that's what's important to me, and that's what's driving me to run.
Hey, tell our listeners why you're qualified to serve on the city council, at least in your view.
Well, as you stated in the intro, I'm a lifelong resident of Kansas City. My husband and I have actually lived in this district for 18 years, raising our family in this district. I've been a healthcare executive in this community. I've also served I've been a small business owner, and I've also served in various community organizations. So I think I'm a well-rounded candidate that will be able to offer a lot to city council.
Edward?
Just have a well-rounded experience and resume of working in the community, professionally and publicly. Past 4 years, I served as your PIAC rep as Alicia Kennedy's appointee, leveraging resources from City Hall directly to neighborhoods. But I've worked with small contractor constituencies, small businesses. I've worked as an educator in public and private charter schools. And also I've worked in a nonprofit sector as well. So that wide range of experience allows me to have an approach to attack the myriad of issues in our district.
You know, Ed, tell our listeners what you'd want to get done during a four-year term. What's the one thing that would have to get done if you get elected to this seat?
Workforce development. We have a lot of opportunities to take our problems and make them long-term solutions, whether it be the potholes, whether it be the sidewalks, whether it be the vacant lots, the beautification processes, and then, of course, the transferable skills. If you can hang a door in a house, you can hang a door in a hotel or in the airport. So we have awesome opportunity to teach our residents and our community members skills that will allow them to earn a living wage, to take care of their communities and also beautify it, but then also have some sustainability to the progress we're making.
Because too many residents lack those skills you're suggesting.
Yes.
Okay.
Or lack the connectivity to the opportunity as well.
Raina?
For me, it's about impacting that murder rate. I would like to see Kansas City get out of that top five rating. And so utilizing my skills to be able to collaborate and bring people together, work with the neighborhoods, work with our police departments, our public safety, and departments and make sure that we can improve the safety for not just the residents in the 5th, but in other districts as well.
You know, dealing with violent crime obviously is one of the issues I was going to ask about today. So what do you want to do to achieve that? There's been a lot of talk about it going back a decade and longer in Kansas City, but the problem persists. What's Raina's platform and agenda for dealing with violent crime?
Well, I think one of the things that has been talked about that we just haven't pulled the trigger on is I really do think we need to look at local control. I think having local control will allow us to reduce some of the duplication of jobs that we have in the city, which will allow us to put more officers out on the street.
Kansas City being the only city in the country that has a state-run police department,
exactly.
Right?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. Mm-hmm. But I also think...
Why would that make such a difference? If we go to a locally controlled department, why would that matter so much?
Well, in essence, I mentioned the duplication of efforts. So, for example, we have 2 HR departments, you know, and these are things that shouldn't require a trained officer to hold that position. We have an opportunity even in the IT departments as well, where the city is already paying for those services. So that may give us an opportunity to streamline some of the efforts and allow more funding or more resources where we need it out in the streets.
I was going to say, if we eliminate that duplication, what does that get us? And what you're mm-hmm. saying is we can get more officers out on the street. Do we need to hire more in addition?
In the interviews that I've had with some of the police officers, some of the leadership there, we actually could do that because I think they've looked at it, actually could do that without having to hire more officers, but it would allow some of those trained officers to get from behind the desk and be able to be out in the community to work on focus on issues like community policing and focus deterrence policing, which actually focuses on specific individuals in communities to be able to reduce those issues.
You know, I thought we were already doing that stuff. I mean, I've heard other candidates suggest some of the same things that you are today, but I thought that the department took on exactly those initiatives years ago.
Yes, so they actually are doing some community policing, but I think there have been some recent cuts, or they don't have the total resources that they need to be able to make a positive impact. I mean, it's obvious with the fact that our violent crime and murder rate continues to rise that what we've been doing in the past has not worked. So we've got to think outside the box and bring some of those other key leaders, organizations together to be able to come up with a plan that really will truly have an impact,
impact. Again, in these conversations, I've mentioned this several times, but the city already spends 76-77% of its general fund on public safety, firefighting, police officers. Is that number not enough?
Well, those that I have talked to, I mean, it's a significant number, and I know the police have asked for more officers out on the street, but they've also asked for resources to put, you know, social workers out in each, which they have one social worker in each station, but they're wanting the needs are so great that they are requesting more social workers in each of those offices. And so ultimately, you know, I think we have an opportunity to look at the budget, to look and work more closely with the commission to see how we can better impact the city. Because like I said, what we've done, I mean, it's obvious, the numbers are there. We have not been successful.
Ed Bell, I'm wondering about your platform for dealing with violent crime. Your opponent just said that she favors local control of the Kansas City, Missouri Police Department. Do you favor that?
I'm not opposed to it, but regardless of who controls it, how we implement and use our resources is what's most important. The best tool that we have is discretion. And when we had our lowest violent crime rates, we didn't have the increase in officers. Actually, we probably had less police officers. What we had was more community programming, more social programming, more wraparound services, and we used our resources in a way that was synergistic. I talk about that all the time. We have, as an educator, we have police officers in schools that call student resource officers, and they're really there to relationship build. We can use police officers in our communities and neighborhoods the same way, because we have neighborhood leaders, neighborhood organizations. Officers are assigned to a specific area. So there's an opportunity to relationship building.
What is the relationship in the 5th District, as far as you're concerned, between the police department and the residents they serve?
It depends. 5th District is so varied. So you have some areas that have a lot of transient and renting populations. Those relationships tend to not be so good because of the transient nature of the residents. And in some areas you have lifelong or tenured residents, a lot of seniors. They're around more neighborhood organizations, and they have better established relationships with police officers. We have the CIT officers. We have the community impact officers as well. So it's really an opportunity to expand the level of programming that's already in existence with police, with neighborhoods, and just make it more well-rounded.
Bottom line, would you hire more police officers if you were a member of the Kansas City Council?
No.
Because?
It's already a drain on the budget, and I think the budget as is isn't sustainable as is. What we need to do is find ways to trim some of the redundancy, as my opponent spoke of, but then also find some other factors that address or affect crime, because we can't arrest our way to a safe city. We have to work our way to a safe city, beautify our way to a safe city, and do some real relationship building.
You know, Raina, we just did a show here on Oakland, California's successful efforts there to lower violent crime. One theme that emerged there was the need to invest more heavily in social services and ensure that these leaders of different initiatives are coordinating their efforts. Is it time here to pass an initiative to spend even more on wraparound services for those prone to violence? Because, again, in Oakland, it's been proven to work.
Yes, I'm 100% in support of that. I would like to see Kansas City become more of a trauma-informed community, one that really supports not only our seniors but our youth, developing programs such as conflict resolution, other things to be able to educate them, and, of course, resources, providing resources, creating jobs for them to ensure that they have the skill set to be able to move forward with a productive life. I think far too long we have overlooked certain parts of our community, and being able to provide those additional resources, I do believe, will help.
Ed Bell, do you favor more money for wraparound services?
Yes, and on a personal level, I've been working with these organizations, whether it be the Kansas City Health Department, CCR, CCO, AFSC, ACLU, Moore Squared. All these organizations and some others have been doing the work with less than enough means anyway. And so it would be very advantageous to do a little bit of incremental increase in financing for these organizations to give them some more capacity, because, again, this is what covers the gap in law enforcement. When you call the police, something's already happened. It's not preventative. And so what we're talking about crime, we need to address the preventative measures. We need to address the conditions that create an element for crime to exist and continue.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking with the two candidates for the Kansas City City Council's 5th in-district council seat, Raina Park Shaw, Edward Bell II. Raina, I have a couple questions for you here based on your campaign website. It offers a 5-sentence agenda on there, a platform for you without a whole lot of detail. Why not offer more detail, more plans on what you hope to do if you win a seat here on the council?
You know, in essence, my website kind of offers a summary there. I'm hoping that will spur conversations, spur people to contact me.
Like this one.
Exactly. Like this one.
You do call for a livability standard, which is a term I haven't heard other candidates use. You list it as clean neighborhoods, healthy citizens, engaged youth, and active seniors. That's a tall order. How will you start working on this if you win your seat?
I think the key is bringing together those key neighborhood leaders and work with the city to establish programs that will help them within their community. I think providing that linkage, far too many of the people that I've talked with have expressed the concept that they feel they've been overlooked or forgotten. So being able to open the lines of communication with the neighborhood leaders and whoever's is interested, those interested parties and organizations, to bring them together to establish collaborative opportunities to improve.
You're also calling for affordable housing, as so many candidates are. What's the definition of affordable in your district, and what needs to happen so there's a whole lot more of it?
Well, for me, the key is, you know, having quality, affordable housing. We've see far too many people that, you know, have asthma or, you know, there's lead in their homes. But having a home that they can afford to live in, that provides them the health, the quality of life that they deserve.
Where are you going to get the money to do that? One member of the current city council is calling for a modest increase in the property tax directed at affordable housing. It wouldn't solve the problem, but it would sort of begin to walk down that road. Is that something you could support?
You know, I believe that we have an opportunity to be open-minded and be creative. I think we can even look at some developers, you know, and some of the developments that are being established and requiring there to be a certain percentage of affordable housing that's that becomes a piece of that. But at this point, I say nothing's off the table. I think in this affordable housing crisis, we have to be open-minded and creative and look for something, a solution that works.
Ed Bell, could you support a property tax increase, a modest one directed at affordable housing?
No.
Why not?
Because it's a regressive tax, and we already see people who are struggling on fixed or limited incomes, struggling to stay in their homes, maintain the integrity and density of their neighborhoods already. What we need to do is look at the equation of having developers and builders kick more money in, alleviate some of those tax incentives. And what we need to do is use some of the funding we have already to create perpetuity situations. I'm a PIAC representative, so we oversee a small percentage of sales tax for capital improvements and redirects. We could take some of that money and begin to create a trust and a seed fund to do some of the renovations, blight removal, and upgrades for neighborhoods. And that can be seen as a small-term mortgage or loan for the homeowner that pays back into the pot, and that creates a sense of perpetuity. And as we add those other elements of developer fees or the parts of the deals that require builders to put into a fund, then that doesn't create a regressive situation for our citizens, because incomes and funds are limited already for a lot of the residents in 5th District.
Mm-hmm. You know, you offer all manner of ideas on your website. Ed, one of them, you want to set up a program to look after the city's fountains. What do you have in mind there?
So, again, I talk about workforce development and Votech training. What this does is it provides an actual hands-on, tangible learning, but also a social learning to learn how to take care of your neighborhood and community. But we are the city of fountains. It just becomes a marketing tool. Having an executive MBA, understand how to leverage opportunities for future opportunities. So, yeah, we already have fountains. We can fix them up. But then also that can be a training program where we sell fountains to other businesses, other municipalities, other entities. And it creates a sense of perpetuity of work and employment.
You also want to eliminate illegal dumping. How would you get that done?
So we need to have a very robust and proactive fleet that is dedicated and committed to beautifying our city. And I feel like a lot of our areas have been overlooked, have been neglected because they may not be main economic drivers. They may not have the rooftop density, but we need a sense of equity for all our residents, and services should be applied across the board. And so what we can do is empower neighborhoods to increase the beautification, the urban gardens, the pocket parks, trash and community cleanups. But then also we just need to have a dedicated force that's going to do it. And we need to measure results. If the results aren't there, we need to find other options.
You also want to, speaking of pocket parks, you want to stick stationary workout equipment in some of those parks to raise property values. Where's the money for that going to come from?
The same place that we use PIAC funds, the same way we use in capital improvement funds. These are beautification projects that have a long-term benefit, not just health, but value for our neighborhoods, because we know healthy neighborhoods are sustainable neighborhoods. Sustainable neighborhoods are neighborhoods that become economic drivers. And so in the same way you see in the plaza and other areas that have nice trails, 5th District deserves to have that too, especially with an aging population. A lot of our residents aren't allowed or don't have the access to get to the community centers or the recreational centers as much, but they can get out and walk. And if there's a trail that connects to a small little exercise station in their park, in their neighborhood, that's a benefit.
Raina Park Shaw, what's your plan to encourage development outside the downtown plaza corridor? I mean, how would you steer attention away from downtown and over to the 5th District in southeast Kansas City?
So in my career, I actually have served on the Eastern Jackson County Workforce Development Board, creating opportunities for individuals in Eastern Jackson County area. And in that, I had an opportunity to experience and meet several key people within the community on workforce or on, on economic development. And being a small business owner myself, I know that it's key to I know what it's like to, you know, start a business and run a business and try to expand your business within the city. So for starters, I would look at the policies and ability for a small business owner to be able to thrive within the community, within
this
district.
Again, there's been all kinds of efforts expended to try to make that easier, but you think we need to go farther?
Yes, I do. I think we need to go further. I think there need to be more opportunities for small business owners. You know, the small business owners have an opportunity to be able to provide multiple jobs for individuals with our community.
Is it time to turn off the spigot when it comes to incentives for developers who want to build downtown? Would that be a clear stop if you win?
I would definitely love to see more development in the 5th District. You know,
and do you get that by turning off the spigot downtown?
I think you got to look at that spigot. I definitely think you have to look at the spigot. I mean, there's no doubt, though, that economic development has really grown the downtown area. We need to have equity in all of the districts. So I would like to see that move further south.
Ed Bell, is it time to turn off the spigot for downtown development?
Not necessarily turn off the spigot. We just need to use better discretion. I mean, we know what downtown looked like 10 years ago, 15 years ago. It was a ghost town. And so sometimes you have to provide some tools, some incentive, make the terrain a little more attractive to come. Fifth District has awesome opportunity for small-scale manufacturing, to do multi-level housing, whether it be mixed use or new homes. But the opportunity is there. We just have to have leadership who's dedicated to bring in the partners who share the same values, and they're out there. Urban America's coming in doing 63rd Street. They share similar values. There are a lot of community partners. But then also, too, when we look at incentives for small businesses, they're the biggest employer of people. So the same way we give tax breaks or tax freezes for others, we could do that for small businesses without hurting our overall bottom line, because the eats are still going to be there long-term, economic activity taxes, if the businesses and the companies are there long-term.
You know, there's a question on the ballot in June, Ed, that would cap the amount of property tax abatements available to assist developers at 50% of what's allowed by state law, much lower than it is now in Kansas City. Are you going to back that idea on the ballot or not?
No, I'm not for that.
Why not?
Because, again, discretion is the most powerful tool we have. A hammer can hit in nails, but a hammer can also take out nails. And so we need to look at the full functioning use of how we use our incentives. Incentives aren't bad. They can be used in a bad way.
Raina?
No, I do not support that either, primarily because I think the more distressed areas may need more than a 50% incentive to encourage developers to come into that area. So I think our areas that are at highest risk would be most impacted by that. So I'm not in support of that.
You know, Ed, voters in this town just rejected a sales tax increase for early childhood education. Mm-hmm. Does the city need to take another crack at that in the next year or two? And how did you vote on that initiative?
I did not vote for that. As an educator myself, I believe that school districts are intelligent enough to formulate ways to come up with funding mechanisms for early childhood education. You had 14 superintendents in unison, in concert, saying this wasn't the appropriate way. Of course, we're all for early childhood education, but that's not the way to fund it, another regressive tax. That's not going to really help people who are paying the tax really feel the impact of the program.
What could you support? If you've already said no to property taxes, I assume you'd say no to sales taxes. They're just as regressive, if not more regressive. What would you back?
It just depends on the kind of tax. Sales taxes aren't bad. I mean, it's an economic tool that is used.
But they're aggressive.
They are. We just passed the Central City sales tax a couple years ago.
The 1-8 cent sales tax for the East Side.
Yeah. And that was a community effort that people could get behind. A lot of it depends on the community will. In other words, is it going to really have a direct impact for the community? But just creating taxes for the sake of creating taxes, that's irresponsible.
So you aren't saying no to the possibility. You just want to see what the package looks like.
Yeah, exactly. It needs to be responsible.
Raina, how about early childhood education, too? How did you vote on that plan?
I voted against it as well, primarily for the same reasons. Our educators were all against it. But also, you know, Kansas City is one of the highest taxed residents in the country. And so definitely I'm not in support of additional taxes. I mean, I know that there are things that you have to do, but I think we need to be creative in how we look at funding that.
Could you support a plan if the educators bring forward something that you could live with?
I could. If they're all on the same page, definitely I'm a strong supporter of early education.
Ed.
And I think something else to mention, that we all know is that Kansas City Public Schools hasn't had a tax levy since the 60s. You know what I mean? So that's something to look at.
1969,
Something to look at. And if you look at other municipalities, when they do their incentive design, school districts have a veto power or some kind of say into if the deal is good or not for the totality of the community. And so we need to look at incorporating those elements. And that's something city council can directly do.
Okay, we're going to leave our conversation there. The two candidates for Kansas City's 5th District in-district seat, Raina Parks Shaw, Edward Bell III. Thank you both for a good conversation. I appreciate it.
Thank
Edward
you.
Bell II. Excuse
you,
me about that, Ed. Yeah. Time for a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about the pay gap between what men and women earn in this country and what women can do about it. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday on the show, we got an in-depth look at Truman Capote's In Cold Blood from an author who found additional evidence in the case. That's a fascinating conversation. Other previous episodes, you'll find them at kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow, Up to Date is co-hosting a Kansas City mayoral debate with the Greater Kansas City Chamber of Commerce. Join us tomorrow for that event, either live at Union Station or on KCUR's airwaves. That's tomorrow morning at 11 o'clock. Well, most of us know there's a pay gap between what men and women earn in this country. One explanation is that women are less likely to negotiate their salaries. But new research suggests something else is afoot. Women, this research says, ask for more money just as often as men do, but they don't get raises as often. That seems to suggest that sharper negotiating skills might help. That, in turn, could help close the gender pay gap. With us today to talk about how to close the pay gap are Kimberly Churches. She's the CEO of the American Association of University Women, an organization that offers free online workshops on salary negotiations and has committed to training 10 million women on the topic by 2022. Kim joins us from NPR Studios in Washington. Kim, good morning.
Hi there.
Wendy Doyle's also with us. She's president and CEO of the Women's Foundation here in Kansas City. Wendy, nice to have you back. Welcome.
Thank you, Steve.
You know, we're talking about how women can negotiate higher salaries here, but just to start off, what's the latest we know about the pay gap between men and women, Wendy? What are you hearing out there?
So in Missouri, we are on par, actually, with the national, which is 78 cents to the dollar that men make for the same work, but that's on average.
That's the national average.
That's the national average, yes. And in Missouri, the average is 78 cents, but it is very skewed. So it's average. So in the center of the state, it's 51 cents to the dollar that men make for the same work. And that's in more of a rural community.
Hmm. Starting in the fall, Kansas City will be one of a few places where it's illegal for an employer to ask about a job applicant's salary history. Is that a step in the right direction, Wendy, and why is that important?
It's a great step in the right direction. That is part of the pay gap. So it's a solution. We love that Kansas City is joining more than 14 cities across the country and 17 states that have banned salary history, and we hope that Missouri, other municipalities will follow suit as well as the state.
Kim, what's your perspective on the pay gap and how progress on that front is going? Are you seeing much progress?
Thanks, Steve. Actually, we're seeing a lot of stagnation, and that's part of the reason why we're taking such a multi-pronged approach to work with municipalities, counties, states, and federal government to improve our pay equity laws. Look, the Equal Pay Act was passed in 1963, and let's be honest, almost six decades ago, the American workforce looked different than it did today. Women are leading more households. That gets to the tax base, consumer spending, et cetera. So this is less about a women's equity issue, and frankly, more about economic security for families. So one, we need stronger pay laws. Two, we need to work with employers, industries, and sectors on improving their own practices, such as banning salary history. And then third is really ensuring that we have the negotiation skills to negotiate on our own financial futures.
And we're going to talk about that here in just a moment. Kim, didn't I just see something that suggests that the more education a woman has, the bigger the pay gap? It's counterintuitive.
It is indeed.
At least
when
it is
you
to
think
me.
About yeah. it, when you think about low-skilled or hourly wage earners, there's a floor, and it's called minimum wage. So you can only go so low. When you get into higher paying, where you've had more education, sadly, you actually see the gap increase. And some of the biggest collective gender gaps are in areas where you'd think of as being very highly compensated, like finance, right? Physicians and doctors and surgeons, accountants. But you see less of a gap when you look at retail, food service, et cetera, because you have that baseline of minimum wage.
Wendy, this idea, you know, that women are in fact asking for more money as often as men do, but aren't getting it. What do we know about why that is?
women simply are not as skilled or confident in the negotiation process. And
it's
so
it's hard, though. It's hard for anybody.
It's hard
isn't it?
For anyone. Yeah. But women are at a little bit that confidence is really what we're seeing is holding women back and having the tools and resources to be able to confidently negotiate a salary or an increase in a raise. So it's that confidence factor that we're seeing.
Help me here. Why is it a more particular problem for women than it is for men?
You know, I think it's just the nature of, you know, looking at backgrounds and how women have been raised and, you know, certainly the gender bias in households happens, you know, at childhood. And so that follows us throughout our entire life. And then when it comes to negotiating right out of college, that first job, women are not as confident in that negotiation process as men are.
Kim, how surprised were you to learn that women are, in fact, asking for more money as often as men do, but not getting it, at least based on this new research that's out?
Yeah, not surprised at all, Steve, sadly, because of the biases and discriminations that still are set forth. Look, our workplaces are still set up with paradigms and systems out of the Ozzie and Harriet era, and the world has changed, but we haven't updated how we think about different gendered roles. And women are just as likely to be the head of household as men are. Women make up almost 50% of the labor force. Women have held the majority of undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees for more than 2.5 decades. Now, and yet still we think of, you know, if you're a mother, women face a motherhood penalty, where if you become a dad or a father, you receive a bonus. You're seen as more trustworthy. You're a family guy. And you see men earning over time more money than mothers do, who may be perceived as being the ones to take care of their children. So I'm not that surprised on the negotiation front. I think to Wendy's point earlier, what is great on negotiation is that, yes, it is absolutely the confidence building skills, but it's also the competence, meaning understanding where your role is in the marketplace, what your skills are valued at, understanding your own geographic area, understanding what other employers are paying for that baseline, so you can come in with the assets and skills to really be able to negotiate your future.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Up to Date, and we're talking about new research that shows that women do, in fact, ask for more money as often as men do in their jobs, but they more often don't get it. If you want to join our conversation with a story or a question along those lines, our number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR Up to Date. Okay, let's talk about some of the basic steps that women should take, and this is based on a worksheet that your organization, Kim, the American Association of University Women, has issued. Step number one, Kim, know your value. You just alluded to that. Explain that one.
Yeah, so that's understanding what your education level, your skills and experience are worth in the marketplace based on the title of job you either currently have or you're seeking. So whether that's an entry-level position, whether that's a supervisory position, a manager position, et cetera, of understanding where your education level is and understanding what that market value is in Kansas City or in the region versus, you know, Washington, D.C., where I sit. They'll have different market value. Mm-hmm. And so once you have the research on knowing where you stand, you have that confidence of being able to build out what that salary band should be for the position you're either seeking or the one you're in.
Is that information, Wendy, tough to get a hold of? Or does your organization help women navigate that?
Our organization partners with the American Association of University Women to provide this local training, facilitated training here in Kansas City. So that's, we are partnering together. We do not offer that, but we certainly point people in Kim's direction and the American Association of University Women. But there are so many resources available, accessible by the internet, by the web, and so it is readily available.
Kim, can women go on your association's website and get more information about how to navigate this?
You bet. So as Wendy said, we offer in-person workshops that are free right in the Kansas City area, and we hope to continue to broaden those throughout the states of Kansas and Missouri, and we're working on that right now. But online, you can reach it at salary.aauw.org. It's completely free. It's a fun, interactive 1-hour course that you can take at your own leisure.
This is interesting to me, Wendy, that the worksheet we're talking about here actually recommends that women practice saying their strengths and achievements out loud.
Yes.
Why is that important?
Because, again, that confidence, and women have been raised to be humble and, you know, a little under the radar. And so practicing out loud, that role playing, is, again, a confidence building strategy.
Step number two, Kim, know your target, meaning what?
Really knowing your range. So if you know based on your, if you've got 5 years of experience in your industry or sector, and you know what you're paid right now, and you've done your research looking at all of the different aggregators like salary.com and PayScale and Glassdoor, et cetera, so you know what that range is, you essentially want to know what that median level is you know you deserve, and what your walk away point is, what you know if they're not willing to play. You're obviously not negotiating just with yourself, you're negotiating with another party or parties. So you have to have that walk away point where it's just time to cut bait.
And that's a tough thing to navigate and to think about, isn't it?
It is indeed. And it particularly is, just as Wendy's been alluding to, you know, there are stereotypes as we think about how males perform in these areas versus women. Women, on average, tend to just put their heads down and want to work hard and not have to negotiate. Men are, you know, if they think they've got 65% of the skills, on average, think they deserve 100% of the pie. So we have to kind of get over those stereotypes and those conscious and implicit biases to allow all to be able to thrive in the workplace, because we know it benefits the workplace and the employers as well.
How women can negotiate higher salaries. That's our topic this segment. 816-235-2888 is our phone number. Asha from Overland Park, you're on the air, Asha.
So my question is that I'm hearing you say that women need to do a better job of negotiating, but how much of this is really about women are doing as good of a job at negotiating, but because of all these biases, the people they're negotiating with think the men are worth more, and they're willing to agree to those higher salaries, where when a woman is asking for the same thing in the same way with all the same skill, they feel like they can say no.
Wendy Doyle?
Yeah, that's a great question.
It is.
Thank you for asking it. One of the things that the Women's Foundation did is we did a research study called the Pay Equity Best Practice Guidelines, and we partnered with University of Missouri to complete that study. And what you are talking about is really the culture of the organization. So if the culture isn't really primed to be able to have that pay equity best practice, then there is going to be that stereotype that you're discussing. So what we encourage is employers to take responsibility to invest in doing a pay equity audit, something very simple to do. Just, do you have an equity in pay as a first step to really try to overcome that culture to make it more equitable? So that's a solution.
You know what? When you guys have been talking about these different sites you can go to figure out pay ranges and that kind of thing, are those numbers accurate? And it sort of raises a question in my mind, Wendy, why is salary still held so tight as such a secret, even among workers who might stand to benefit from sharing that information more? There's just a code of silence when it comes to
Absolutely.
That stuff, which I'm never quite sure I've understood.
And it really has, again, starts with that corporate culture, and it was always, you know, always kind of that unknown expectation within the workplace of, we don't discuss salary, that is taboo, and it's inappropriate to do so, and that you could potentially be fired for talking about your salary.
That's all to the benefit of the higher-ups and not the workers.
Absolutely.
Though.
Absolutely. And that's the culture. That's what we're trying to overcome. Again, what Kim has been talking about is biases and stereotypes of men, women and men, but it's also within the corporate culture.
Do you ever recommend that a woman, you know, ask somebody else, hey, what are you making? Is that a way to, or are you asking for trouble?
That's actually part of the pay equity best practice guidelines that the research study we did, is paycheck transparency really creates that culture of, you know, leveling the playing field. So that is one of the best practices.
Hey, Kim, what do you say to that? That's a radical idea for some people. What do you make of that?
I mean, the biggest thing here is sunshine is a great disinfectant when you're trying to keep your whites white, but it also works in this instance.
You sound like a journalist, Kim, and I appreciate that as a lifelong journalist, Jim.
But here's the big thing on this, Steve, is that you have to make sure you know what your individual laws are in your state. Now, we're working to advocate to pass the Paycheck Fairness Act on a federal level, which would ensure that employees cannot be discriminated against or face adverse issues if they do talk about salary. But right now, there are areas of our country where if it's in your handbook that says, you know, your employee handbook, that you're not allowed to discuss salary, you can be fired for that. And
no,
so that's
kidding.
Why we're working on these laws, because, again, opacity is not the path forward. It's that level of pay audit. It's that level of transparency and understanding that you're living your own organization's values. If you purport that you believe in inclusion and diversity, you should be willing for a little sunshine on these issues.
Kim, how old is a law like that? That's got a date from the 1920s or 30s, right?
Right, right. And so the Equal Pay Act did a lot of good work to try and level the playing field, but it wasn't enough. It's why the Lilly Ledbetter Fair Pay Act was signed by President Obama 10 years ago. It's why we've been working so hard on the Paycheck Fairness Act, which just passed with bipartisan support in the House of Representatives, and we're working on that in the Senate now, because we have to ensure that we can have that level of transparency so all workers are protected. Last I'll say on this is to the terrific caller who called in, this is not all on women's shoulders. So I would also argue it's important for men to take this workshop online or in person too, because it allows you not just to be a bystander, but to be an upstander, to be a real ally to women in the workplace.
Yeah. How women can earn more money on the job. That's what we're talking about here. 816-235-2888 is our number. Roger from Plattsburgh, Missouri joins us. I think he's on the road right now. Roger, good morning to you.
Good morning. How are you today?
Well, thank you, Roger.
Good. Interesting article. I recently came across a study, and the study was talking about the qualifications to get a job. And men would go into a job interview having 10% of the skill set and know that they were fully qualified to take on the job with only 10%. A woman, on the other hand, needed 115 or 120% of the skill set to feel comfortable applying for the job. Somehow or other, we need to be able to get women to reduce from 100% and know that they're going to pick up some of it along the way in the job.
Hey, Kim,
anyway, it seems like that would be an impact on that.
Kim, what do you make of that?
Boy, I'm smiling, caller, for your comment, for sure. Really true, and these just get to age-old stereotypes of men versus women in these roles. That's why teaching these skills and arming you, you know, the way that women, when men are demanding what they're worth, they can seem as confident. When women are demanding as what they're worth, they can be seen as aggressive. So mm-hmm. we also have to make sure, as we're looking at this, is that we're teaching a lot of emotional intelligence in this negotiation course as well, because you're not, again, negotiating just with yourself, you're negotiating with others. And so keeping that positive and really key is being cooperative throughout this process, so that it's more about we together in this negotiation process versus I versus you. So I think that really helps too. But, you know, your caller's absolutely right that too often women feel like they have to be at an A++ before they're ready to put their hat in the ring, where men know that they're going to learn on the job as well. And we can only counter that with more education and more programs and building the confidence skills that women need.
Wendy Doyle, I'm guessing that our caller's comments aren't the first time you've heard those remarks.
It was a great point, and I appreciate his call very much. You know, we spent some time with some college women preparing to negotiate their first job, and I asked them, who did you go to seek guidance on your salary negotiation? And they all, 90% raised their hand and said their fathers. They would reach out to their fathers again, and I asked why, and it's because my father has done the negotiation more than my mother has. So again, it's that stereotype, that history of men being more successful in doing it than women.
Back to some calls here. Teresa from Lenexa. Teresa, good morning.
Hey, good morning. How are you?
Well, thank you, Teresa.
Good, thank you. I just wanted to make a comment. I'm in education, and, you know, education is notorious for having a lower pay scale, and I really believe that so much of that is the result of being a female-dominated culture, because women tend to not negotiate, and they tend to acquiesce to a lower pay scale. So that's just the comment I wanted to make, and I'm curious about how, as a culture in education, we might increase salary at use. The salary scale as a result of the influence of a female society.
Right. Yeah, thank you, Teresa. Right. Kim, take a whack at that. What could educators do? And do you buy the caller's notion that the reason teachers don't get paid as much is because the profession has been so heavily dominated by women over the years?
Well, you can look to friends in Japan and in Scandinavian countries where teachers are paid at a much, much higher and are valued in the same way as they are with doctors and lawyers and the like. So that's an American issue, to be sure, but most assuredly in female-dominated fields. But I think for Teresa's point, it's really good to note that even in female-dominated industries such as nursing, there's still about an 8-9% gap on males to females. So as males enter fields like nursing, they're earning more than their female counterparts, which is, of course, absurd and something that we need to address that can come from better practices, pay audits, et cetera. But it's furthermore about occupational segregation, this idea that we kind of steer men into some fields and steer women into others, or women make choices to go into certain fields where they feel like they can do more for their communities. And it's how we value those jobs. So yes, sadly, in this country, we undervalue teaching compared to many, many other sought-after professions monetarily. And there is work that can be done on that, including on better practices with education employers, educational institutions, nonprofit organizations. There's a massive pay gap in our nation's nonprofit institutions. This is not just a corporate problem.
Wendy Doyle, what could educators do to change this?
Yeah, just to add in, I completely support everything that Kim has said, but just to add, it really starts at the top, and you look at the most senior level position within the education field, and that's the superintendent, and primarily that is a male-driven position. And we have been kicking around the potential of doing a research study as to what a solution could be, and one suggestion has been to look at the composition of the search committee. And is it primarily led by men sitting on the search committee to fill that superintendent position? So again, there are so many factors that contribute to the pay gap.
You know, I want to just round out our conversation about steps that women can take to improve their ability to make more money. Step number three, Kim, on your worksheet is know your strategy, meaning what?
So really, again, this is about understanding with whom you're negotiating and how you're going to counter any negative feedback to your requests based on your own value proposition, based on your education and experience that you're bringing to the job, but being prepared to counter those negative reactions to it of somebody saying to you, I'm sorry, you know, we really see this as a $50,000 a year job, not a $65,000 a year job, and how you're prepared to counter that with being able to add in your own value to it. And that's a lot of what we teach in the class. And I'll add to that, you know, as we think about these nuances we've been talking about and kind of general stereotypes for men and women, this gets even more difficult when we look at people of color. And so how Black women negotiate, how our Latina sisters negotiate for their salaries and for their benefits. So that's a lot of what we work on strategy, is really ensuring that we know with whom you're negotiating so you can be prepared for success.
Wendy, the final step, step number four, practice, meaning?
Practice the role playing so that you feel very confident in what you are going to say.
People overlook this step a lot, don't they?
They absolutely overlook. That's the real value of going to the in-person training that AAUW has. They do the role playing on site so that you can get comfortable. But even identifying a friend or a colleague or a supporter in some way to be able to practice what you are going to say.
Really good idea. Good advice here. I appreciate our guest today as we talk about how women can negotiate better salaries. That was the voice of Wendy Doyle, president and CEO of the Women's Foundation here in Kansas City. She was joined by Kim Churches, the CEO of the American Association of University Women. Kim, put out that website again that you gave out a little bit ago that helps people move down the road here.
You bet. You can find us at salary.aauw.org to register for a free negotiation course.
Sounds good. Kim, thanks again. Wendy, appreciate your time.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll be live at Union Station for a debate between Kansas City mayoral candidates Jolie Justice and Quentin Lucas. You can join us for that event at Union Station or tune in here at 89.3 tomorrow morning at 11. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, and Emily Aiken. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.